Hello and welcome back to the RHS Gardening Podcast. Each fortnight we bring you a mixture of features and discussions exploring every aspect of gardening, plant care, pest control, growing your own fruit and vegetables, and expert seasonal advice on what you should be doing in your garden right now. I'm Tony Dickerson, one of the advisory team at RHS Garden Wisley in Surrey. We answer members' gardening questions via phone, email and in person at RHS shows and gardens. On this edition of the podcast, we're at the 2013 RHS Hampton Court Palace Flower Show. Coming up, practical seasonal advice including pond maintenance, growing beans and promoting better blooms on your irises. A special focus on the new escape zone at the RHS Hampton Court Palace Flower Show, including roses, butterflies and delicious grow-your-own recipes. Our team of horticulture advisors are on hand to answer your latest gardening questions. And, as always, we'll have the latest news on RHS events and summer activities. But first, let's get some seasonal practical advice on what to do in your gardens now from the experts at the Hampton Court Palace Flower Show.
I'm Sarah Cook from the National Collection of Sir Cedric Morris irises. And Sir Cedric Morris was a really famous British artist of the 1920s to 60s and was an iris breeder as well. So I've had to learn how to grow irises very well to look after his heritage. And now is the absolutely perfect time of year to give irises the conditions they need for next year and the treatment they want. And what you need to do is to cut the leaves down a bit to let a bit more light in and then give them a really good feed of, say, a rose fertiliser, high potash, which really keeps them going. If they're a very congested group, they have the same problem, no sun on the rhizomes, and they all get smaller and smaller, not enough feed, in which case you must lift and divide them. And July, August to September are the ideal times to be doing that. Lift them up with a fork, cut the leaves down, cut the roots to 2 inches about, throw away the unuseful rhizomes, the small rhizomes, keep the bigger rhizomes and replant them with the rhizomes just at ground level. Water them in if it's very dry, give them one more water maybe 3 or 4 weeks later if it's still in this sort of weather, really hot and dry, and then they should grow very well. If you divide them, they may take a year to get re-established and flower again. What they need is space and food, a bit like me, in fact. I think the best all-time iris bred in Britain was one called White City, bred by a woman called Olive Murrell. And my favourite iris is one that Sir Cedric Morris named for Olive Murrell, called Benton Olive.
My name is Francis Saunders, and I'm from Eco Pond. At this time of year, it's important to maintain the water level in your pond. And if you can, top it up with rainwater rather than tap water. If you don't have access to rainwater, ensure that when using tap water, you use a good dechlorinator to remove the chlorine from the water. It's important to top it up in order to make sure that the level of water is appropriate, A, to the level of plants in your pond, but also to reduce the amount of heating of the pond, which increases as the water level falls. At this time, it's likely you're going to have quite a lot of algae growth in your pond, so if possible, remove blanket weed, or if necessary, treat to control green water algae, which otherwise are going to cause problems later in the year. Ideally, you can treat it naturally with something like barley straw, but this is quite slow to react, so the alternative is to use something like extract of barley straw, which will become operational straight away. One of the easy ways to assist in removing blanket weed from your pond is simply to take something like a bamboo cane and twist it in the water, and you will find that you can wrap quite a lot of the blanket weed around it and then just pull it out without too much difficulty.
I'm David Turner, product manager for Fothergill Seeds. It's a surprising amount of veg that you can still sow. From July and onwards, but starting you've got beetroots, there's dwarf beans, you can do some of the cabbages of a second sowing, which will still give you time to get some crops for the spring, carrots, spring onions, some of the broccoli. I mean, there's quite a large amount that you wouldn't expect you could still sow, but you can, to get spring and even autumn crops out of. I think the biggest problem at the moment, and I've heard it several times since I've been at the show, is a lot of people who've sown carrots and have lost them, and there's a lot of rodent damage. And unfortunately, mice get in, they find the nice succulent roots, and they'll work their way along a line, and you'll see huge patches where there's nothing growing. The easiest thing, I think, to get around that is raised beds, even carrots and such vegetables in troughs or containers, because they do actually make quite an attractive adornment to a patio as well. Climbing beans, runner beans, dwarf beans can also be sown. They will need a lot of water, in particular in the weather we're having at the moment, to get them going, get them established, and constantly, once, particularly once they're growing well, will need to be watered once, even twice a day. Early in the morning, late at night, or late in the evening, to stop the burn on the leaf or anything like that, and that's the best way to keep them growing and growing well. It's also a good idea with runners, make sure you crop them regularly. The more you crop, the longer the season will be, and the better and more fruit you're going to get off the plants.
You can find more tips and advice on growing your own fruit and vegetables on the RHS website, rhs.org.uk/grow-your-own. Here you can also find video guides to the key jobs in the garden. I'm Tony Dickerson, and you're listening to the RHS Gardening Podcast. Escape is one of the three new zones at the Hampton Court Palace Flower Show this year. It's a magnet for the grow-your-own enthusiast, a shopper's paradise for the stylish home and garden buyer, and a mecca for the rose and floristry fanatic. So here's an enticing picture of some of what's happening right here at the Escape Zone.
This is Mandy Armand, the show manager of the Hampton Court Palace Flower Show. We've called it Escape because it's really an escape to the country, considering we're only 10 miles outside of London. And here you will actually see a wonderful array of different edible gardens. We've got our growing taste marquee, where we have growers specialising in herbs, fruit trees, fruit plants, and combined with that, we have specialist artisan food producers. So it's a real sense of taste. And in addition, we have the Pig Restaurant and the School of Artisan Food doing some amazing demonstrations within the marquee itself. Further afield, we have the Rose Marquee, which is a stunning display this year. It's all about 50s vintage, and it's been carried off beautifully by the rose growers, floristry colleges and professional florists. Then you move forward, we have a wonderful area this year concentrating on butterflies and bees. Our dome is spectacular, the Butterfly Dome, in association with the Eden Project. And I understand it's the biggest exhibit of butterflies in the UK, where we have 3,500 tropical butterflies in an amazing tropical setting.
Hi there, I'm Paul Allen from Butterfly Jungles, and we're in the dome here at Hampton Court. We've got about 1,000 butterflies in here at the moment. There'll be up to about 3,000 by sort of mid to late week, so it's going to be quite something to see. And the reason behind the tropical species we have in here is to actually draw people's attention to butterflies, because we're losing our pollinators worldwide, actually, not just a British thing. And there's a huge story behind the tropical side with the farming out there, because they produce butterflies for exhibitions. Whole villages get involved in the tropics, and they're self-sustaining, so they stop growing crops, grow butterflies instead. Great message behind the whole thing, and actually protect the rainforest where they live and work. So there's a great backstory behind the tropical side here too. But they've got some really unusual plants in here as well. The Eden Project has supplied lots of different bromeliads and a few different rare bits and pieces. So there's lots of botanical interest in here going on. Butterflies predominantly eat nectar from flowers. Some of the tropical species actually digest pollen as well. They're great pollinators out in South America, because they carry it around on their proboscis and take it from flower to flower and pollinate as they go. But we've also got the owl butterflies here, which are quite a good one for people to see, which are fruit feeders, and they love to feed on pineapples and bananas and things like that. For the native species, the best thing to do is actually find out butterflies that are local to your area and then plant in the relevant caterpillar food plants, because this is something that often gets overlooked. So there's all sorts of things you can do to mix into your garden. If you plant sweet rocket, for example, which is a great one to mix into a herbaceous border, really pretty flower, strong scent in the evening, you'll get green vein whites, orange tips and small whites breeding on those. They eat a little bit of leaf, turn a blind eye to that, but it's not huge amounts of leaf. And sweet rocket's quite a robust plant, so it doesn't get affected by the caterpillars, but you'll get lots of those butterflies in your garden. A great one to grow is stinging nettles. Whenever we do a project, we have a big pot of stinging nettles, which you place in a sunny place in the border. By growing them in a pot, you contain them because they're actually shallow-rooted, so they can't get out of that pot. Just stick the runners around the edge to keep them contained. And if you let them go to seed, just pull up the seedlings around them. But you can actually cut them back through the year, keep lots of fresh growth. And that will feed red admirals, commas, painted ladies, peacocks and small tortoiseshells. So that's a really important one to have in your garden.
Hi, I'm Charlotte Slade and I work for Jane Packer in London. We're currently exhibiting at the RHS Hampton Court Flower Show in the 1950s Rose and Floristry tent. In here is abundance of beautiful things from the rose growers with big names such as David Austin, and then all of the colleges and schools around the country are also exhibiting. We've been given a theme of 1950s and you can really see that theme throughout the whole tent, from the bunting, it's even the theatre where there's demonstrations taking place looks like a 1950s railway station. With floristry, I mean, anyone can give it a go. I'm sure everyone receives bouquets from friends or you pick up flowers at the supermarket, and the key thing is to have confidence and not be afraid. At the end of the day, as beautiful as they are just flowers. We run courses in the school daily. We have 1-hour courses where it's just come along and have a bit of fun with flowers and just build up that confidence to get creative yourself, really. So if you're thinking of growing flowers in your garden at the moment, the roses are delightful. We can get scented roses, peonies, sweet peas, delphiniums, hydrangeas, stocks. It's endless the amount you get in summer, which is really lovely. Got lots of choice.
Michael Marriott from David Austin Roses, and we're here in the Rose Marquee at Hampton Court. We've got a classic rose garden, really, and the one thing that we did this year is put in lots and lots of climbers to create lots of height. We were able to do this year because at Chelsea we had actually very few, so we always have a number of climbers ready-made on arches, and so rather than forcing them for Chelsea, we're able to just keep them going, gradually ticking along, and use them here at Hampton Court, which is perfect. They are such a versatile plant, and if you think about it, there's no other plant that can potentially have a beautiful individual flower, a fantastic fragrance, flower for 5 or 6 months of the year, and be easy to look after. There's nothing can touch it at all, so every gardener should have lots of roses in their garden. If you all want to grow roses for the first time and really don't know anything about it, there's two important things to do. One is choose a good variety. Some rose varieties are absolute dogs and they get every disease going and they're absolutely horrible, and others are just absolutely fantastic. You know, they flower for months on end, have a fantastic fragrance and are really tough, reliable and healthy. So make sure to choose those ones which are really tough, reliable and healthy. Come and ask advice, come to us, come to the other rose growers and ask them which the best varieties are. And then the other thing is prepare the ground really well. Roses love humus-rich soil, so make sure to mix in plenty of really well-rotted organic matter into the soil before planting. Maybe use some of the mycorrhizal fungi in the soil at the same time as planting. And remember that roses love water. So at the moment with this hot, dry weather, water them really well and the roses will respond very well indeed.
So at the heart of the Rose Marquee is the most amazing display, and it is at the launch of the Rose of the Year 2014, which is called Lady Marmalade, and it's bred by Harkness Roses and introduced by Roses UK on behalf of the British Rose Trade. It's a winning combination of modern rose with vintage charm. The colour is absolutely stunning and it's highly scented, and in addition to that, it has good disease tolerance, so I'd say a great rose for the future.
My name's Paolo Rigo, I'm the director of Frankie Seeds, and we're at the RHS Hampton Court Flower Show today. This is the Growing Taste Marquee, which is really, really food from the seed to the plate. In the Grow and Taste Marquee, there's people selling food to take away, and then there's lots of gardens, vegetable gardens, all themed gardens. So there might be chili gardens, just grow your own curry. There's our Roman garden as well. So there's a whole mix of different food gardens mixed in with ingredients you can take home. Our garden is called Pliny's Garden, and it's really based on the garden at Fishbourne Roman Palace, which is the largest Roman palace north of the Alps. It's a very, very special place in Sussex. Amazing mosaics, and that's what inspired us to do our garden here. And all of the planting in the garden is what you would find in Rome, or what the Romans brought to the UK. So things that we think of as even being quintessentially English or British, you might be surprised to see in our garden here. Things like pears, things like apples the Romans bought as well, but lots of vegetables. Cabbage and lettuce were already present in the UK, but what the Romans did, they bought varieties from Italy which were hardier. Of course, Italy's a very cold country. It's 74% mountain. People always forget that. They think of Italy and they think of Naples, which is really unusual because it's hot in the winter, but actually most of Italy is cold in the winter, and it can get down to minus 40 in some parts. Well, the Romans love cabbages, and they use cabbage an awful lot. So in our garden we've got things like Cavolo Nero kale from Tuscany, and that is used modern days for to make Ribollita Toscana, which is a stew. It's a national dish of Florence, which you make the day before. Ribollita actually means reboiled. It sounds better in Italian. Italian food is peasant food, really. It's very simple, it's local. It's very wholesome and filling and tasty, of course. And so what we've done, we've got a whole host of regional varieties. We've got chicory from Treviso, and Treviso is very cold. I ski in Treviso. And so that must have sub-zero, otherwise it won't turn red. And lots of British people say to me that chicories are bitter. But until they've had sub-zero, then they are bitter. And then once they've had that cold snap, the more cold the better, then they're going to be tender, they're going to go red and become sweeter. And I think we're scared to cook chicories in Britain as well. In Italy, that would just be pan-fried with garlic and pancetta, used in risotto alla trevigiana, which is risotto with Italian sausage and Treviso chicory. It's very, very nice. Also in the garden, we've got zucchini. The Romans certainly would have used squashes, pumpkins and courgettes in their cooking. They ate the flowers, as we still do today in Italy. My father-in-law throws away the zucchini and he only eats the flowers. And we're the only English-speaking country that doesn't say zucchini. We say courgette, because the Normans were here for 400 years. So a lot of our vegetables, instead of saying eggplant, we say aubergine. And so, yeah, there's a big French influence on our food as well in Britain, but certainly a lot of Italian varieties here.
My name's Emily Ray. I'm here with Plants for Presents at Hampton Court. We've got a Grow Your Own Curry stand here in the Growing Taste Marquee. We've got loads of different unusual herbs and spices, things like kaffir lime leaves, lemongrass, ginger, turmeric, plants that maybe people don't realise that they can grow in the UK quite easily. They do need a bit of protection from frost, but it is quite easy to get really quite a good crop, and these plants have so much flavour in the leaves, and that's really what our display is about. So one of the things that we're handing out from the stall is grow your own curry, Thai curry. So we've got a Thai curry recipe to give away, and they're free from the stand, and they include ingredients that we're growing and that we're selling from the stand. So kaffir lime leaves is one, Thai basil is another, lemongrass is another, and chilies. So those four ingredients will make the basis for all the flavours that you get in a Thai green curry. Most of the plants that we have on the Grow Your Own Curry stand are a little bit more tender than the garden plants that that you might see. They almost all really do need to be kept inside. The only exception is the larger lemons and larger kaffir limes in very sheltered areas of the UK can be grown outside when they're mature. All the other plants that we're selling from the stand are tender plants and should be brought inside in the winter. That doesn't mean a specialist greenhouse. It doesn't mean a specialist massive conservatory. It just means a nice light room somewhere away from frost in the winter. Most of these plants are also sun-loving plants, so they come from hotter parts of the world than we get. Luckily this week we've got a bit of sunshine, but that is something to remember when you're growing anything a bit more exotic, is that sunlight more than temperature is the most important thing, particularly in the winter when we've got shorter daylight hours, is really making sure that you get them on a south-facing windowsill or somewhere where you can get a little bit more light onto the leaves. Watering varies a bit between plants. The trick to remember with citrus, for example, is that you water heavily from the top and then let them dry out in between waterings. You don't want the roots to be sitting in water. You don't want them to be waterlogged. That's the same with the curry leaves and any of the plants that grow in quite well-drained soil. Some things like the ginger need a little bit more water. They shouldn't let the soil dry out with ginger. You should try and keep it as warm and moist as you can so that the roots will carry on developing.
My name's Lee Thornton. I work for Surrey Heath Borough Council, and we're here at the Royal Horticultural Society Hampton Court Garden Show with the Movable Feast, which is our garden entry, our first entry into the show this year. Well, we're right on the by the entrance to the Growing Taste Marquee, and we have a garden which is basically designed to be a movable feast, which is the name of the garden, and everything in it is edible and is also movable. The project came about working with a group of army wives from Deep Cut Barracks in Surrey, where our Surrey Heath Borough Council is based. And they approached us about some ideas they could have, because they're always getting relocated around the country. And when they move, they have to totally clear the garden. And so they wanted some ideas for things they could take with them. So from that developed a whole project, originally from a workshop. And now we have a whole range of things here, movable. We've got tub trucks, we've got army boots, we've got recycled shopping bags. We've actually got some catering-sized tins with everything planted in as well. So we've got a whole garden which is bright, vibrant and colourful, but it also is edible and practical. And to me, the important thing is that it shows that anybody could garden anywhere. And if anybody comes and just goes away from this garden with one idea and goes home and does it, then I think we would have succeeded. I think the thing that's really caught people's imagination are the tub trugs. These are the typical floppy buckets you buy for all sorts of things in the garden. There's so many people haven't actually thought of planting things in them. And they're great because they're movable. They're a good size. We've got leeks growing in them. We've got potatoes growing in them. We've got raspberry plants growing in them. So they're fantastic for that. And I think that's how, you know, a lot of people have said, oh, I've got a couple of those in the shed. So I said, well, get them out of the shed now and get them planted up. I think the main thing is there's all sorts of containers you can use. But a really important thing is to get some drainage holes in the bottom so that obviously the roots don't get waterlogged. So just pierce some holes in the bottom of anything. Nice bit of decent soil in there, hopefully your own compost if you've got the space, and away you go.
The RHS Hampton Court Palace Flower Show runs until the 14th of July. For more information on the show and its three zones, Escape, Grow and Inspire, as well as details of how to purchase tickets, visit the shows and events pages of our website, rhs.org.uk. Here you also find details of the RHS Flower Show at Tatton Park, which runs from July the 25th to the 28th. You can also win a pair of tickets for this year's Tatton Flower Show by visiting the podcast page of the website, rhs.org.uk/podcast. But hurry, you must enter by next Thursday to win. If you can't make it to Hampton Court or Tatton this month, here are some ideas of other events you can take part in across our other RHS gardens. Top sweet pea growers from up and down the country will be exhibiting at the National Sweet Pea Show between the 13th and 14th of July at Harlow Carr. At Rosemore, there's the Poetry and Book Week between the 14th and the 19th of July. See the early stages of North Devon knitting impresario Alison Murray's latest spectacular Big Books project, consisting of 3 9-foot-high knitted storybooks. There will also be book readings in the gardens from local authors and book signings in the shop. At Hyde Hall between the 1st and 4th of August, combine a visit to this inspiring Essex garden with the opportunity to buy a fantastic range of plants and garden sundries from over 50 specialist nurseries and trade stands. At Wisley between the 24th of July and the 1st of September, we have the Great Garden Adventure, sponsored by Witten Investment Trust. It's a great day out for all the family as kids go free. Details of all these events, as always, are on the website, rhs.org.uk. Every month on the RHS Gardening Podcast, my colleagues from the Horticulture Advisory Team answer your gardening questions. The RHS Advisory Service is free to RHS members, and we can be reached by phone, email, in writing, or you can come and visit us in person at the RHS shows. So let's hear what questions you've been asking this month.
I'm Lee Hunt. I'm a horticulture advisor here at Wisley, specialising in urban gardening.
Hi, I'm Jenny Bowden. I'm one of the horticultural advisors here at RHS Garden Wisley.
And now a message which has been left from our phone lines.
Hi, I'm Penny from Ormskirk. I've got a problem with my roses. The rosebuds are forming, but the flowers aren't opening properly. Instead of flowering, they just wither and die and fall off. Can you tell me what's going wrong?
That sounds very much like a problem called rose balling. Many of our garden plants have been so highly bred with very large, dense flowers that if early in the season, especially if we have very wet weather, sometimes wet weather followed by cold conditions, the outer petals are actually physically damaged and they go brown and dry, and then the flower itself cannot open. And it's just one of those things associated with the weather. It may vary from one year to the next, but plants like roses are particularly susceptible. And I guess there's a few others as well, Lee.
Yeah, something like peonies. It's those very soft petals that peonies have, like roses, that very quickly get mushed when the rain comes along and then get dried. And that makes that paper coating that the flowers just can't break out of. If you catch them early enough, actually that outer shell can be just carefully teased out and pulled away. And then often the flower literally springs open. So it can be a remedy where you can literally turn your damaged flowers into ones that are fully open in one fell swoop.
But I guess if they just fail to open even after those sort of remedial actions, the only alternative is to pick them off. Of course, with roses, it's not too serious. They will produce many, many more blooms. Peonies also will have blooms on the side shoots, but perhaps not quite so many.
And I have heard of varieties of roses which just insist on always having rose ball type blooms. And again, like Tony was saying, there are certain situations where there's just not much you can do about it. And it tends to be a characteristic of roses, which are very, very intricate, double type flowers. And they just seem to have real trouble with opening. So all you can do is dig the plant out and plant perhaps something else then. Not a rose, I hasten to add, but put a different rose in a different spot.
And I guess also roses obviously do want a nice open situation, but if you can keep them away from the drip line of trees and just surrounding shrubs and so on, good air movement and so on, that may help.
And I've got a question here from Amanda Nelson, who's from Belper in Derbyshire. I've recently started gardening. I love to cook and would love to grow my own herbs. What should I start with? Can we grow mint without it taking over the garden?
Well, I think on that, mint is a great plant to grow because it's actually very difficult not to grow it well. In the garden, certainly it will run rampant. You often hear suggestions about planting it in an old bucket and then planting that actually in the garden. I myself would always put it into its own container. Good compost, again, a John Innes loam-based, soil-based compost, and it will romp away in there, but at least you'll keep it contained. You'll probably have to divide it every year, cutting it in the clump in two and repotting half of it and giving away the other half to your neighbours, perhaps.
Mm, what seems to happen to it is it just heads straight for the edges of the container as soon as you put it in there.
It's the rhizomes, the creeping stems, incredibly rampant, and it doesn't seem to need too much cultivation to get it growing very well. And as I say, in the open garden, it will simply run between the roots of your existing plants and pop up all over the place. And as I say, definitely something to avoid in the garden.
And there are many different varieties of mint that you can choose from, aren't there, Lee?
There certainly are. I think it's also, you might need a couple of mints to get the classic flavours in your cooking that you think about. So if you're doing something like a Pimm's, then apple mint or spearmint is going to be ideal. But something like black peppermint is much better if you're cooking something like lamb. And actually, if you added that to your Pimm's, it would make it feel like you grated some pepper into it. So it's one to avoid in that. Another very pretty mint, though, is just the pineapple mint, the nice variegated cream foliage, slightly crinkly, and that makes a really nice container plant. Jessica Sellers has emailed from Edinburgh, and she says she's recently moved into a house with a huge and ancient wisteria. She says she can't make head nor tail of the pruning advice. It sounds so complicated that she's tempted to get rid of the shrub and get something easier instead. Should we bin it? Should we prune it? Is her question. And she also wants to know how to prevent it from shedding lots of leaves.
Well, in the wild, of course, nothing would get pruned and would flower absolutely happily. But the way most climbers flower in their native environment is just to scramble to the top of a tree and then send out flowers at the very, very top, which I suppose is really why we prune most of our climbers. If it's really overgrown, you can renovate it, which means cutting it down to its main framework, leaving just a framework of branches in the winter time. But there are other less drastic approaches, aren't there, Lee?
There are. I'm thinking I'm going to go back a step as well, because for getting this pruning right, I think people often do feel it's really complicated. But the basics of it is you have your framework, which is basically you tie in long stems horizontally to cover the space. So whether it's a fence or a wall, and that forms your framework. From that then grows side branches. And these are the very long whips that you see. In summer, what you do is these long whips, you shorten them back to about a foot, just cutting beyond a bud. That gets rid of all that excess growth. But to get the best flower buds forming at the base, you then go in again in winter, in about February time, and you shorten those shoots that you cut back to a foot to just a few little buds. And that's it. That's all you need to do. And that creates those little spurs at the base that are going to have lots of flowers on the bottom. So for most people, actually, I think if you can get your head around that, it's just a two-step operation where once you've done the initial pruning in summer, you can just come in the winter and carry on, almost taking your pruning as your guidance, and it's done. I think the problem, though, in this case is that it has got big and it sounds like it's got very heavy. And as Jenny is saying with the renovation aspect, you often have to go harder and deal with some of these big branches because they become too much. And that's when you need to be brave. And in the winter time, take your pruning saw and remove some of the older, thicker stems, but leave behind some of the thinner ones that you can train in to replace it.
But very important, I guess, Lee, to emphasise, you do need to preserve some of that existing woody framework, because it's off those that you will get these spurs, this fresh growth. If you cut it all hard back, it would certainly grow, but you'd be getting just masses of young shoots and you'd wait many, many years to rebuild the framework. So the thing to do with a saw is carefully cut back selected branches in sections so that you can be sure that you're not cutting away anything that later you wish you'd left.
It seems such a shame to be frightened of this, because I get the sense from Jessica that she's moved into this house, this is ancient wisteria, and she doesn't know what to do with it. She'd rather get rid of it. But potentially her whole house is going to be dripping with these blue or white flowers in May. And this is why people grow them. There really is nothing else to match it for flower power when they look really good. So if she will take on the challenge, then I think she could have a fantastic looking house.
And is this leaf dropping, is that just because we've got a very big climber here and it's perhaps struggling for water?
Well, they do like more water than you would imagine. In their native environment, they come from forests where quite often by rivers. And so we tend to put them in the most inhospitable places and expect them to do well. So usually there's in a rain shadow, so basically underneath the eaves when the rain does fall, it's not actually, the climber isn't actually getting it. So it's always a good tip, if you possibly can, when planting a climber, plant it about a foot to 18 inches out from the wall and point it towards the wall, and then it can capture a bit more rain. So that may be one reason why it's dropping some leaves. Another one could be sudden changes in temperature, big temperature fluctuations. They may lose some leaves. Something could be wrong with the roots. They could be too dry, or the other end of the spectrum could be too wet. There's a multitude of possible reasons they shouldn't be losing leaves. What do you think, Lee?
I think you're right. And I suppose they'll always lose just a few leaves. is what plants do, isn't it? They have a lot of them, and if it's very windy, for example, some might be stripped off. And by tidying it up and getting it back on the wall, I think that problem would be a lot less noticeable. Because particularly if you end up having a border beneath it, even if it's not very wide, a lot of those leaves are going to drop less noticeably into the back there rather than on perhaps a driveway or paving in front of it.
And thanks as always to my colleagues from the advisory team. For more information on how you can receive free advice from the team by becoming a member of the RHS, visit the website at rhs.org.uk/join. We're out of time on this edition of the RHS Gardening Podcast. We'll be back in a fortnight with special features from the RHS Flower Show Tatton Park. Until then, remember to follow us on Twitter at @the_RHS and like us on Facebook. For now, from me, Tony Dickerson, and the podcast team, goodbye.